being called Dialogue Assassination has since progressed to Dialogue Conspiracy, 79 weekly hour-long programs. And we'll move right on and see what... We have a guest today, May.
Yeah,
and a guest that many people are familiar with. You want to introduce him?
Okay, Paul Krasner is here today, the publisher of The Realist, who's been writing in the public eye for
13 years, right, Paul? Publishing 12 years?
14, actually. I'm just like the airlines and the buildings. We skipped the 13th.
You skipped the 13th. 14 years of publishing, and Paul's written, has a book published, and has been writing articles and been on the media for a long time. Originator of the word yippee. And he's
also softcore pornography.
Oh, softcore pornography.
That's my contribution to the language.
It is softcore pornography.
Paul's been on the show here before. Did you explain how the yippee came about then? Just aside
the origin
from
of the word yippee? Yeah. No, you'll have to do that, Paul.
Maybe people would be interested, since it seems to be a household word, almost as household as a Spiro tea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, briefly, in the end of 1967, we realized that when the Democratic Convention was going to be held in Chicago, and we wanted to have some kind of protest. When I say we, it was specifically Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and myself, who were all veterans of demonstrations from Berkeley and Washington. And we had seen violence, you know, on the part of policemen at all kinds of demonstrations, and yet we felt it was important just to make our presence there known. I was naive. I just thought that we would use the Chicago parks as a sanctuary, and those people who wanted to go out in the streets could, and those people who wanted to just be there as a kind of living example, the media is the message, living example of an alternative lifestyle, could be there as their statement. And we were thinking of names, you know, it was called a Festival of Life, an International Festival of Life. And since I'm a media person, I just think of media as a kind of that it could be used as a sort of psychic judo, use their competitive thing to present something which is what happened, because the papers had headlines like, yipes, the yippies are coming. But what I thought was, I remembered that this was at December 1967, and in October of that year, in Haight-Ashbury, the diggers had a funeral for the hippie, because they said it had become a media term, and they wanted to change the name to Free American, which had a nice ironic tone to it, because you could see some sweet little old lady calling after a young long hair, why don't you get a haircut, you free American? So we knew it wouldn't pick up, but I just juggled around the letters. And for one time, I came up with Kids International Festival. I thought, Keef, that might be, and then just juggled around more and thought of Youth International Party, and it worked out fine, since because it was essentially a youth rebellion, and it was international in scope. It was happening every, that was when Danny the Red was involved, and you know, and there was things going on in Mexico and in Japan, so it really was international. And party, of course, had a double meaning, because it was party in a sense of political party and party in a sense of festive. And the initials were YIP, and I just yippies. I just knew it was like a revelation. I just knew they all thought I was babbling crazy. I said, you'll see, they'll have analyses in sociological journals saying why hippie and yippies are different. And it went beyond my wildest dreams, because they even had a yippie queen in some girly magazine giving an interview. They made it up entirely. In fact, it came full cycle. I knew it had become a successful addition to the language when my mother said to me one day, you know, Paul, you're really a hell of a nice guy, even if you are a yippie.
You think it'll get in the dictionary someday?
Oh, perhaps, yeah.
That's what, you know, Jerry Rubin said, that everyone can make their own law. You know, if you want, you can have a law made in your name. And he wore that Santa Claus suit, you know, to the congressional investigation, and they made a law that you can't wear a costume or Santa Claus suit.
Yeah, but Jerry Rubin was so interested in his image that he hadn't been sure whether he was going to go in a Santa Claus costume or a circus costume.
Yeah.
So he went in Santa Claus, but he used his circus routine. He talked about it's a circus. You know, he forgot. He got his dialogues mixed up.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, you say you're a media person, and you've been publishing, well, you have published in the last issue of The Realist, a lot of material by May. And you've dealt with conspiracies and the assassinations and government and everything in the realist. Now you've been attacked by another local Monterey County underground or alternative type newspaper. And just before we came in the studio, I handed you a copy of it. You want to read it and then respond to it, maybe? Or I'll
yeah,
read
let
it
me do that again, that as briefly as possible. It's so unspecific that it's hard to respond to it. This is from, it's signed NOS staff members. It says, for more extensive material on the Watergate Hotel incident with a tie into the Lewis Tackwood story, which was run in the June issue of the NOS, articles by May Brussel are available at FM radio station KLRB in Carmel. The articles by May are printed in The Realist. While we recommend May's articles, it is truly unfortunate that the same magazine has some of the most sexist, and then they have to explain what they mean by sexist, contempt for women, which is a sexist statement because sexist can be contempt for men, too.
Yeah.
A material to be found on any newsstand in America, thereby contributing to the exploitation of women as surely as any other oppressive team. Well, I don't take it personally, but I resent it because, I mean, when in 1958, in the very first issue of The Realist, we had a joke which was about this man who had seen God, and he had died, and he had come back, and all the scientists gathered around, and they asked him to please explain what was God like. He said, I can't tell you. And they pleaded and pleaded in the interest of scientific research. So he finally agreed to tell them, and he said, well, first of all, she's black. On a symbolic level, that and Steve Allen repeated that on one of his shows. He said it was his favorite, most meaningful joke. And then around that time, too, I had an editorial. And this was 10 years before this was actually followed up. An editorial suggesting that the designations of in employment ads and want ads for help wanted female and help wanted male, I just suggested that those were should not belong there because they were discriminatory. So, but I've also discovered that people respond to material on the basis of their own psychology. So, for example, when we ran a cartoon and later made it into a poster, and it was called One Nation Under God,
yeah, I remember
and
that.
It showed an anthropomorphic deity committing anal intercourse upon Uncle Sam, and it was called One Nation Under God. And so some people resented this and say, why did you have to bring homosexuality into it? Why didn't you use the Statue of Liberty?
Yeah.
So now, in the current issue of The Realist, there's a 4-page cartoon called Rose America's Baby, which I wrote and Dick Gindin drew. And to take off on Rosemary's Baby, except it's a case of political witchcraft, which starts with Richard Nixon marrying the Statue of Liberty, and then mistreating her,
thought.
You know, and so the centerfold is this coven, and it shows everybody from Martha Mitchell and Spiro Agnew to Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley, and instead of the devil raping Rose America, which is the Statue of Liberty, it's a gigantic animalistic television set whose sexual organ is actually a horn of plenty, out of which all of these advertisements come. I mean, it had worked on a lot of symbolic levels. And so one of the people on the staff of the NOS thought that this was exploitation of women because the Statue of Liberty, a female figure, was being raped. And, of course, it is true, she is being raped, but she's being raped by the media. I mean, you know, that's a truthful thing. That is exactly what's happened. Women have been raped by the media, you know. I realized this again when I saw a newscast recently that talked in San Francisco about a San Francisco businessman who took to lunch a woman executive from the National Organization of Women. And the newscaster commented, he said, while the businessman paid for her lunch, she did light her own cigarette. And this was presented as if this was a sign of her liberation, when actually, to me, it was a sign of her slavery, because the history of cigarette advertising in this country has, it started out with just men smoking in the pictures. Then they would show a woman in the same picture. Then they would show a woman saying to him, blow some my way. Then they would show the woman holding the cigarette between her fingers, and then finally, actually smoking it herself. So, in that sense, you know, a cigarette is the lowest form of rape.
Yeah.
And I think that it's easy to attack the realist because there's this graphic picture, when I think that the No Staff would be much wiser to attack cigarette commercials, for example, as really sexist, murderous, actually. Anybody who writes a cigarette commercial is involved in murder. You know, it's very much more indirect. But I think you have to really redefine what the meaning of violence.
Of course, you know a lot of people in the national scene, in women's organizations, that this hasn't affected at all. This is just a personal thing of some women in town here. One woman in particular. It isn't, I don't think anybody who really understands women would feel that you're coming down. I can't believe it.
But I do think it's important to expand that consciousness to the point where people don't think of liberation as an isolated intellectual exercise. You know, it begins with your own body. And for people, it always amuses me to see people smoking cigarettes while they're talking about ecology.
Talking about liberation and ecology.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was an article, now we'll get back into conspiracy newsletter, I think, dialogue conspiracy. There was an article in the paper this week about a French spy scandal in which 48 top political figures are involved in corrupt financial deals and influence peddling. And there's a gentleman there he's a former civil servant, who has knowledge of a succession of scandals, which he said is like a black tide at the end of the system. And he wanted to expose these scandals. He's a member of the Communist Party in France, and he's collected information. As an agent there working within the system of the civil service, he's collected information for 14 years on corruption and scandal, and he wants to break it in France now. And he said, in quote, "The scandals that I am denouncing," he said before going to the judge's chambers, "have been known for several years, and I hope that people responsible will be punished, and I'm going to tell everything in court." And I bring it up, he talks about the burgeoning scandals and the wide political repercussions. And I bring this up because, on a show maybe a year and a half, when we first started a year ago or so, I was saying that the scandal of America, of the political assassinations, hiding the conspiracies, is going to bring America to some kind of a subservient position in the world scene in terms of bargaining or peace talks or trade or weaponry. And I'm not usually into a red scare like, you be careful, Russia will control us. I'm not afraid of that, except that I know that the truth of the conspiracies in the United States of killing John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the major ones, plus a lot of minor murders, a few hundred along the way, are known by the Russian intelligence and by the Chinese intelligence, and that they have a way, by controlling us and catching us in our own web of information, to blackmail us and bring us down to our feet. And the thing that this particular man is talking about in France, about involving 48 top political figures in all kinds of corrupt deals, and being a member of the communist group there, will come in this country sometime. The scandal of what happened in Washington through the 60s and 70s is going to come down on us in terms of blackmail. And when Nixon first made his trip to Peking and then to Russia, it was right after the Soviet Union published articles that Lyndon Johnson and the CIA were involved in the assassination. And Chu Enlai came out with an article in Mexico, "The Truth Isn't Told on the American Assassinations." And within 2 weeks after this disclosure came out, and it was in Buckley's column in the Monterey Herald here, why Nixon was making arrangements to go to China, go to Russia. And the control of our public figures and of our weapon system of what we'll do or won't do, I think eventually will be determined by a counter-espionage that's kept track of all these murders and can blackmail all the top people in our country because they were involved. And that the truth, I think it was the very first show when the Pentagon Papers broke, and I did a show here in June 1970, and I said the truth has to be told about the political assassinations and conspiracies, otherwise this country will be so shattered as it builds up and more people hide it, and the truth has to come out.
Well, do you think that with all the legal messing around, the delays and the extended hearings and everything, that and the way that the Watergate affair in particular is being covered, that the truth is ever going to get out, or it's going to have any impact on the election? Or...
Well, it's hard to know. You know, I brought in an article for people who've read The Realist or get copies and are up on that Watergate article that we had in the last issue. that came out, you know, went to the printers in July 13th of this year, and in September, this is 3 months later, September 18th, the Newsweek this week, has a four-page article on the Watergate. Now, that's unusual when an issue has happened and the men were arrested to keep that much information going. And the issue this week, for those who have followed the program so far, want to get a background on the Watergate, the Newsweek is an excellent article, and it's called The Spies Who Came In for the Heat. And there's a few sentences here that are pertinent to the opening of the Watergate, because I think if you even go into that, you end up back where the political assassinations were and the scandal that exists in Washington in manipulating the electoral process. The powers that be want to close the case, and it looks like, okay, seven men are indicted, that's it. And they didn't mention John Mitchell or Maurice Stans, and they haven't called in Martha Mitchell, and they don't intend to disclose the secret $10 million that was set aside before April 7th. But the people on the radio, like the talk shows on KGO, we just happened to listen last night and the night before, people are calling in. Wherever there's talk shows, people are asking about the Watergate. They said, where's Martha Mitchell? She knows more than they're saying. And if the interest is generated around about Martha Mitchell or the secret $10 million, they can't keep a lid on it forever, because it will be newsworthy. Every time something new comes out, it becomes newsworthy because it becomes more of a scandal.
But I keep mentioning this statement by the chief executive that's running for re-election, when he was asked about the involvement of the White House, and the Democrats were screaming that this goes all the way to the White House, this conspiracy. And so the press asked the chief executive, was the White House involved? And he came back with the statement, nobody on my present staff was involved in that.
When you say the chief executive, do you mean Herb Klein or Ziegler?
or Nixon.
Or was this
Clark
German
McGregor.
Haldeman.
Was it German that... No, I'm speaking of...
the White House.
T. Nixon.
Yeah. Well, he can say nobody on my present staff.
But I mean, the point of bringing that up is, this may be a minor point, but as far as the American public picking up on these things, he said nobody on my present staff, and any White House reporter there who wanted to maintain his job longer than the 5 minutes it took to answer the phone call from his editor would not ask, well, what about the staff that was your staff at that time? Yeah. So the question wasn't asked, but I'm sure that
but Time
some
Magazine
thinking
brought it up. Time did, and Newsweek brought
it
up.
But to me, that one statement, and now maybe I'm blowing it out of proportion, but to me, that one statement made by the President of the United States, when he knew what the answer that the press wanted. But that one statement would be enough, I think, for most Americans to throw up their hands in disgust, and if nothing else, not vote for him, but certainly maybe not even vote for anybody, if that's the caliber of person you have as president.
Well, I think the caliber of person, I mentioned in the article, The Realist, the caliber of person that has people just step down instead of being investigated, like Will Wilson with the Texas stock scandal. He was, you know, second in the Justice Department, chief of criminal division. The ITT thing, never investigated. There was perjury. There were all kinds of suits, contradictions under oath, you know, all kinds of lies.
I think that that's where the media, and I'm speaking to this because Paul is here, because I happen to be involved, like my life's work is the media. And I think that to let the media drop that as much as they did
was bad,
because I think unless people spell it out in black and white, the public doesn't pick it up.
Well, that
statement was horrendous. It was.
But see, I think you underestimate the tendency of in my office. I don't have a sign that says think. I have a sign that says rationalize, and I think there's a tendency to underestimate the capacity of people to rationalize. And so somewhere, when the president makes that statement, somewhere in people's heads is a buzz that if you put it on a magnetic tape and spelled it out, it would say, of course, the president has integrity, and he fired those. So they take it as a positive thing when he says, nobody on my present staff.
Well, this subject came up last night on that radio show where a woman called in and said, I can't believe that Martha Mitchell doesn't know something, you know, and why isn't she called? And the radio announcer said, well, she's not in public life anymore because her husband has resigned from that position.
Yeah, but that wasn't a radio announcer. That was the staff conservative.
The staff.
And he has a vested interest in untruth, I suppose.
I mean, it's so obvious that when John Mitchell had this important position with the committee to reelect the president, and then Martha Mitchell calls up and says, I've been kidnapped and wounded, you know, and inoculated, and and I've seen Cops and Robbers, Games of Politics is Cops and Robbers, and I know Dirty Thing. And then a few days later, John Mitchell resigns from that committee, and then the top men in there, Maurice Stans is involved receiving the cash, the chief fundraiser. I got a call from a gentleman this week to remind me that Mr. Dell, Dale is the vice president of ITT, and he is the second man in command of that committee. That Maurice Stans was in charge of the financing, and Dell, vice president of ITT, was in charge of the programming of the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. He had an official capacity. But they don't want to bring the ITT into the committee to reelect Richard Nixon either, because the funding, the scandal, everything. So the ITT is carefully being kept out. But at the first time when the men were first arrested, there was a suggestion of the ITT involvement here, too.
Well, and let me see if I can tie up what Phil is saying with some of the material that you brought today, because, see, I think of the media, I think that the media in the United States are guilty of complicity, that they've been to Presidents Eisenhower, Johnson, Kennedy, and Nixon what Goebbels was to Hitler. The only way that you could do what you did in Nazi Germany was with the complicity of the media. And I think the same thing is true here. One of the most striking examples is the history of the New York Times and its reportage of political assassinations. Because I don't know if people on the West Coast realize that even though the New York Times is essentially a New York newspaper, it is considered the paper of record. Almost editors all over the country and all over the world get the Times. This is their source. The New York papers, the New York Post, as well as Time and Newsweek, they all base, and as well as the...
it's the final word,
actually. The radio and television, you know, they use the New York Times as kind of... almost an outline for the things they're going to cover and the importance which they're going to assign to it.
They also have the New York Times News Service, which supplies
right.
a lot of...
Which supplies the San Francisco Chronicle and the LA Times
yeah.
with stuff.
Well,
we have a report by a guy who's done research specifically on the Times handling...
Of the assassinations.
Yeah.
I thought maybe next week I'd do a whole show on just the headlines of the New York Times and how they covered the three major assassinations of Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And they have a definite vested interest in a financial thing. For one thing, they published the Bannon book of the Warren Commission when it came out, the Warren Report. But they have taken a specific stand, and no matter what evidence comes in otherwise, they are right there to tell you no conspiracy continuously. But the background of the media in keeping down conspiracies is understood when you read a book by Kim Philby, My Silent War, and he was the head of British intelligence who worked his way up and turned out to be a Russian spy and went over to the Russian side just a few years ago. And he told how he saw Hitler's youth and the being put down, the young people in Germany, and being killed and put in jail, and he realized that there were conditions in Germany that needed altering, and that the communist scare kept Hitler beating these people up and killing them and locking them up in jail. And Phil realized the danger of Hitler very early, and he went back to London and started writing for the London Times and covered the Spanish Civil War as if he were pro-London Times policy. And with an editor of the New York Times and the London Times, they praised Franco and put down everybody who was fighting, you know, opposing this fascism. And he already knew he was going into intelligence work, and the way he would ingratiate himself was to follow the policy of the New York Times and the London Times. Then he went back to London after the Spanish Civil War and started right into British intelligence and worked his way up. So that it was so slanted, even at the time of the Spanish Civil War, against one way of thinking, the New York Times and London Times, that it shows you that they weren't objective at all.
Yeah, well, I think that also we should, you know, we talk about media. There are areas that should not be neglected, like television, for example. I don't think it's any accident that Billy Graham goes on the Johnny Carson show and makes an equation between drugs and witchcraft, you know, because we're too sophisticated in this country to have anti-Semitism. But in order to maintain power and control, you have to divide and conquer.
Yeah.
So the hippies and the freaks make a better scapegoat than Jews do in this country, because you have a Jewish vote where you don't have a freak vote.
The Pope came out this last week, and I'm reading articles on the Pope since I got a document of a researcher, a man who's done a lot of work in Asia and all around the world, researching different parts of political conspiracies and tune me into the relationship of the Pope.
KLRB FM Carmel.
Aristotle Onassis in controlling the flow of a lot of hard drugs all over the world and political posture. And it has to do, believe it or not, with the importation of heroin from the Golden Triangle down there in Asia and the reason for the war in Asia and who's making the money. So I began, after I received this information, I never included the Pope in conspiracies, began to read. I thought, well, I'll start reading some articles about the Pope. And 2 days later, this was just last week after we met this man in San Francisco on the weekend, there was an article that the Pope came out against sex, that sex leads to drugs. Did you see that article? And that sex, and you know, knowing that people like sex, then you say, well, then they're all going to be drugged, and then he's in on the drug traffic. You know, it oversimplifies it, but as people are getting freer with their body and getting more liberated and can express themselves, then he relates that taking drugs is cause, it starts with sex. And then today I read
think that if he was involved in drug traffic, then that would cut down on business.
No, it's a rationalization then. Uh-huh. So you've gone into, there's a lot of rationalization and propaganda for saying, oh, now you're taking drugs, where drugs are actually brought in by people, you know, imported, and it's the biggest industry in the world today, billions and billions of dollars.
Paul, getting back to this idea of media complacency with government, you know, and helping them carry out whatever goals they've got, do you think that you can ever prove that in any time frame except as history?
Well, you can do what I try to do, which is present evidence and let people judge. You know, like I watched the premiere program of Laugh-In, which is impossible to watch for an entire hour without even chuckling. And it's important to know that the producer of Laugh-In, Paul Keyes, has written jokes for Nixon. And if you analyze the humor in it, I took notes for that hour, and you analyze, there were two jokes about crime in the streets. There were a lot of jokes about Barbara Streisand's nose, things like that. There were though they had a black on, Isaac Hayes, he did a joke making fun of Lawrence Welk's accent, right? So it's kind of insidious in a way. You know, my daughter, who's 8 years old, came to visit me, and on the plane she saw, from New York, she saw a movie on the plane. And I said, what was the name of it? She said, I don't remember, but it was about a black robber, you know? So that these black exploitation films are, you know, where does the money come from to present these films, you know? Why is now Gene Hackman and Al Pacino doing a film about hitchhiking? Mm-hmm. This ties in again with something that I heard you do on the news once about these placemats at Howard Johnson's, these right. anti-hitchhiking things. It would be interesting to know by what process those came to be the official Howard Johnson's placemats, which showed a bunch of angry middle-class citizens in a car shaking their fist at a hippie hitchhiker.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was an editorial this week, you talk about the news, Schmitz had, you can read his editorials from the Los Angeles Times when Schmitz came out and said there was a conspiracy, you know, in the George Wallace shooting and regarding Arthur Brammer.
Okay, let's get to that in a second. I hate to interrupt you in the middle, but we have to do our bit to please the FCC and identify the station.